Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at the Bulwark, and I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal, Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter, Notes from the Middle Ground, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. Our special guest this week is Ben Wittes, editor-in-chief of Lawfare. This is a different sort of episode of Beg to Differ because, as it happens, Ben Wittes, Bill Galston, and I are all in the same room. We're attending a meeting in Texas, and the others are in their usual posts, which means it is a little bit of a fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants operation. I don't have my mic. Ben's using his phone. But I hope you'll all bear with us. Should be fine. And also, there's going to be a lot of extraneous noise, so we apologize in advance for that. All right, so I'd like to begin with the foreign policy news. Iran conducted a huge attack against Israel over the weekend, launching more than 30 missiles of different varieties, drones, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, they say. Well, there are two things to say about this. First of all, the United States, France, Britain, and a number of Arab nations participated in blunting this attack on Israel. So let us start there. Ben Wittes, first of all, do you think the Iranians knew when they launched this attack with the slow-moving drones, with the, you know, telegraphing their attack well in advance, and then announcing as soon as it was over, we're done? Do you think it was intended to be sort of not that damaging and therefore kind of more for show than for real damage? Or are you in the camp that says, no, they didn't know that all these things were going to get blown out of the sky? They really intended to do massive harm.
So I consider myself wildly unqualified to assess Iranian knowledge and intent, which strikes me as very similar to sort of trying to live in Donald Trump's head. I just don't know how to do it. I will say that if they didn't understand, if they weren't trying to signal that this was largely for show, they really underestimated Israeli and American air defenses. And I think they're a little bit more militarily sophisticated than that. They enabled an incredible display of what the United States and its partners, including the Israelis, but not limited to the Israelis, is capable of with respect to both missile defense and particularly defense involving these quite slow-moving Shahed drones, which, not coincidentally, are the same drones that the Russians are using to destroy a large portion of Ukrainian cities. So I think the likelihood is that they did anticipate that this would be repelled and that this was some kind of more theatrical display than an attempt to kill a lot of people. That said, I don't want to say that with a lot of confidence. And I do think it is important to, you know, the amount of ordnance on this, you know, really, if these had hit Israeli cities, you would have had an extremely, extremely dangerous and deathly situation. I think I am probably more in the former camp than that this was a serious attempt to hit the Israeli military very hard. That said, I don't want to overstate my confidence of that.
Linda, as somebody who, like me, lived through the Iranian hostage crisis and all of that, it does strike me as just a little rich that the attack that the Iranians are retaliating for was by Israel on an Iranian consulate. And one of the reasons the Iranians are so upset is that this violates all of the diplomatic niceties and diplomatic codes that have been in effect for decades and centuries, and you don't attack diplomatic facilities. And I'm thinking back to, you know, Tehran in 1979.
But, well, let me just correct you there. Yes, it was, they were in the consulate, but it was the head of the IRGC headquarters in Syria. So yeah, they happened to operate out of the consulate, but.
Exactly. Just right. As Hamas operates out of civilian places. On the other hand, embassies and consulates all over the world also hold spies. We all know that. But anyway, not necessarily terrorists though, as this is. Okay. So I want to just explore a little bit Biden's role here. So Biden, in my judgment, it sort of frustrates me when I talk to supporters of Israel and they shake their heads and they say, oh, Biden's been weak, he's been terrible, whatever. And I'm thinking, excuse me? I mean, he has been the most pro-Israel president, arguably, in history. But there is something that he does and that he does with Ukraine, and he's doing it a little bit, arguably, I'll hear your views, a little bit here, whereas that is self-deterring. So he supported Israel to the hilt in its reaction to the Iranian attack and helped shoot down some of these drones and missiles. But then very publicly, the administration said, do not retaliate again. You know, let it take the win, end of story. And I can understand giving that advice to the Israelis directly and in person and in private, which I think is good advice. But doing it publicly, don't you think it sort of makes Biden look weak?
Absolutely. Well, what it makes him look is like a politician, like he is appeasing his left. You know, he can't totally appease them on Gaza. So, well, let's throw him a bone this way. And I thought it was a very bad look. Look, it is absolutely wonderful that he put American lives at risk. He put American airplanes in the skies to help shoot down these missiles, drones, etc. And by the way, I think you meant to say 300, not 30.
Mean to say 300.
So, I mean 300. Yeah. You know, the idea that they knew that this was, they were all going to get shot down. I don't think so. I guess I beg to differ on that, Mona. I think this was a serious attempt on Iran's part. It was, after all, not from surrogates. It was not launched from, you know, Syria or someplace else. It was launched from Iran. And when you send that many missiles into the air, whether they're cruise missiles or ballistic missiles or drones, the idea that none of them would get through and cause a loss of life is almost unfathomable. And so I, first of all, am somebody who believes Israel has to retaliate. How they retaliate, exactly what they do, I don't know. But I don't think you can ignore that kind of assault on your country. I mean, would we stand for that? Not likely. Mm-hmm. And while Biden mm-hmm. has been a steadfast friend of Israel so far, I don't like his being so public about this. He should not have been public about it. You're right. He could have said this privately in his conversation with Netanyahu. But to say it publicly is, I think, wrong.
Okay, Bill and Damon, I haven't included you in this part of the conversation. If you have something you're burning to say on this, please let me know. Otherwise, I want to turn to the domestic implications because we currently have four separate bills on foreign policy that are on foreign aid, rather, that are pending, and I'd like to get to that. So do you have anything on this?
The question confronting Israel is how many fronts it wants in the Middle Eastern. Does it want something approaching a regional war? Is Israel willing to take the risk that if it retaliates against Iran, Iran will unleash Hezbollah with 150,000 missiles supplied by Iran, some of which are extremely sophisticated? Yep. That's the issue.
Yeah, that is a fair point. Damon.
I know what Linda means when she says they have to retaliate, but of course, necessity is not really in operation here. It's a judgment call. And much as I totally get that if this had happened to us, we probably would respond pretty severely. But if we were in Israel's situation in the Middle East, already 6 months into this bloody war on one front with missiles bearing down on northern Israel in another direction, and such a thoroughly humiliating to Iran display of defensive capability last weekend when this happened. Do they really have to? I would say no, they don't. And it probably the wiser move would be to not, simply because, I mean, if it had been deadlier, then yeah, I do think they would have had to, and we would probably be in a pretty horrible regional war right now. But look what happened. I mean, Iran had this remarkable display of muscular military effort, And it was an utter failure, a humiliating failure, showing that, you know, Iran can do its best, and we swatted away like flies. So I think that might be enough for now. I would put it in, if I were Netanyahu, I'd put it in my back pocket and take it out again in a few weeks or a couple of months from now if Iran tries anything else similarly precipitating, then maybe bring it out or, you know, issue back channel warnings that you're not going to get a second chance here before we pound you into the dirt, something like that. I really fear that a retaliatory strike, which the Israelis continue to indicate they're going to do as recently as today, Wednesday. Once again, I fear, you know, every cycle of this brings us closer to the whole region going sideways. And I really don't look forward to seeing that happen. That's all.
Thanks. You know, maybe this is a reminder that a really strong defense can be as demoralizing to an enemy as the, you know, potential deterrent effect of a strong offense. If you're Iranian military planners and you see that, you know, your big armada of drones was just, you know, popped out of the sky.
Yeah. Does Iran appear stronger or weaker now than they did a week ago? I mean, I think it's clear to everyone with eyes to see that Iran is in a way a paper tiger, at least when it comes to a direct military assault on Israel. Through its proxies, it can still make a hell of a mess, and we still have to deal with that. But that's a little bit of a more subtle problem than Israel actually launching major airstrikes at Iran at this moment.
Right. Okay, so at home, back in the dysfunction land that we call the American Congress, we have a few news items. So we're recording this on Wednesday. We have Thomas Massie, Republican representative, also a libertarian, doesn't matter, announcing that he would join Marjorie Taylor Greene in moving forward the motion to vacate the chair. If Mike Johnson puts a bill on the floor to give Ukraine aid, and remember that Johnson only can afford to lose two Republicans in any vote because of the closeness of the House. Well, it also turns out that Mike Gallagher, who was scheduled to leave his seat at the end of this week, has announced just today that he's going to extend his stay long enough, I guess, to vote on the Ukraine package. So now this gets interesting and convoluted because there are four different packages. One is Israel aid, one is Ukraine aid, one is Taiwan aid, and the fourth is a package that includes a TikTok ban, a Lend-Lease Act to reduce red tape in supplying military aid to Ukraine, and authorization for the United States to sell seized Russian assets. So Ben Wittes, I'm going to come to you. We're faced with all kinds of possibilities. There are amendments to each of these bills, which could get incredibly complicated. You can easily imagine a scenario where nothing passes because of amendments.
Correct. First of all, let's start with the good news. The good news is that Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, has at very long last done the right thing and announced that he is prepared to hold votes in a timely fashion on Ukraine aid. Undoubtedly, the Israel attack over the weekend strengthens his position in that regard, in the sense that even if you detach Ukraine aid from Israel aid, they're still connected in a lot of people's minds. And I think the need for the Israel package was very pointedly on display this weekend, as well as the asymmetry, by the way, between the what we're prepared to do for Ukraine and what we're prepared to do for Israel.
Can you just say a word about that? Because the Ukrainians were pretty downhearted about the fact that we did this incredible operation to shoot missiles out of the air for Israel and we haven't done it for them.
Yeah, it's amazingly demoralizing if you're Ukrainian to watch U.S. air defense capabilities while the city of Kharkiv is being reduced to rubble and large sections of other cities are being destroyed by precisely the same weapons that we have now shown are capable of being treated like a fireworks display if you have F-16s in the air. And these are exactly the weapons that they've been asking for, right? And the Ukrainian, I actually spent a lot of the weekend with Ukrainians because there's a whole conference of Ukrainian in Washington, sort of 600 of them. And, you know, I literally did not hear a single one who begrudges the Israelis the degree of air defense protection that the United States has helped them develop and in some cases simply supplies. But there is a real plaintive kind of why not us? And, you know, if you get them talking, the more sophisticated among them will say, you know, Israel's not a NATO ally either. There's no treaty relationship with Israel. It really is a very parallel situation. And the United States takes responsibility for Israeli security in a way that is exactly what we aspire to. And so I would say it's not disappointment with the American performance, but disappointment and a kind of lack of understanding of why they cannot have the same sort of relationship, which is really the difference between life and death for large numbers of Ukrainian civilians. Those 300 drones killed exactly one Israeli civilian, which, by the way, is one too many. But you send 300 drones into Ukraine, which the Russians do, by the way, and it kills a lot of people. And so for them, this is a very bittersweet display of what the United States is capable of. So look, the good news is I think we're going to get a vote. The bad news is, if you haven't noticed, the House is insane. And if you don't structure the vote exactly the right way, who knows what could happen? And the further bad news, because Johnson waited so long to do this and McCarthy waited so long before him, this is 6 months late, and the Ukrainian position has really deteriorated in that time. And, you know, a lot of people have died and will die unnecessarily, both civilians and military in Ukraine because of this. And nobody can promise that this is going to end in the right way because of all the factors, Mona, that you just identified. And then finally, I just want to say this because we're going to have to start talking about it as soon as this vote happens and we get it done. We're going to have to start doing it again. Because one of the things about, you know, billions of dollars of military aid is that if you convert them into artillery shells and weapons, you then use them, you know, about 6 months to a year from now, we're going to need to talk about the next supplemental. And every time we do this, the situation deteriorates because of our own dysfunction. And we need to start getting ready now for the fact that we're going to have to do it again.
Damon, some Republican member told Punchbowl that if the bills that Johnson is introducing onto the floor, if they fail to take off, then the floodgates will open and Republicans will flock to sign a discharge petition that will force it. And my colleague Joe Perticone wrote that he's skeptical of this, and he said, and I'm quoting, there's no greater sin in the modern GOP than working with Democrats on an issue that's been roped into the politics of the moment. And even the most hawkish Republicans know that. Just ask James Lankford. So what's your sense of it?
I honestly can't tell, because as strange and dysfunctional as the Senate sometimes feels, the House is like 10 times crazier. And, you know, I think even aside from GOP craziness, there's the fact that the margin is that narrow. I mean, even if everyone were sane and operating in good faith, it would be very difficult to get something passed if you're relying only on the majority's votes. Now, it's a whole other thing if you actually have a functioning legislature where if you know, if a bunch of Republicans don't want to pass this, that's okay, because 50 of them will, and then all the Democrats will vote with them, and then it easily passes. But with the Hastert rule and like all the other things wrapped up with it, you end up with this situation where you have to get every single Republican on board with one of these bills, save one or two people. And if someone's in the bathroom or sick, like, then it becomes impossible to even pass anything. That's a situation where, as I think Ben was indicating, like, you know, where we're like walking a tightrope made of dental floss. It's just crazy. And my question is Johnson even going to make it through any of this as speaker? I mean, you already had Marjorie Taylor Greene before the break saying she was going to try to vacate the chair. And then Massey was threatening to go on board with that yesterday. And of course, then the question is, well, maybe he'll survive because Democrats will come to his aid. But then that's the same result, just by a different path, because as soon as he's known as having had his speakership saved by the dreaded evil Democrats, he'll then fall from another angle. It's just he'll be the most toothless speaker you could imagine. So I can't even begin to guess how all of this is going to play out over the coming days and weeks, with the different bills and, you know, the possibility. I don't want to throw really any shade at the Democrats, because the Republicans are so effectively stepping on themselves all the time. But it is also true that it's an election year, and there are certain political incentives for Democrats to kind of put things in those bills that will become poison pills. So then it'll go down so that the Democrats can blame the Republicans for the fact that it didn't pass. I mean, the incentives are so cockamamie and screwed up in this situation that I'm just going to kind of sit back, and I won't be eating popcorn because it isn't entertaining, but it's going to be like watching a kind of slow motion traffic, you know, highway accident happening right before. And all you can do is pray there won't be fatalities.
Okay. My new favorite expression is a tightrope made of dental floss. I love that.
And waxed, no less.
That's great. So my understanding is, I'm no expert on the minutiae of parliamentary procedure, but my understanding about this motion to vacate the chair is you can introduce such a motion and it doesn't mean anything, but if you introduce it as a privileged motion, it forces a vote. And she hasn't done that yet, but she could at any time. So Bill Galston, I love to hear you comment on anything that you like that you've heard so far. But also, you know, what's your evaluation of the Democrats' calculations here? I mean, they have seemed very eager to get a vote and help Ukraine, even if it means helping Mike Johnson to keep his seat. And they can't be big fans of Mike Johnson's. But what do you see as their incentives and their possible plans here for the next several days?
First of all, you know, Mike Johnson has already become very accustomed to violating the Hastert rule. You know, he has done most of his work since he became speaker on a bipartisan basis, using a procedure called suspension, which means the ordinary procedures of routing bills through the Rules Committee are set aside. But the penalty that he pays is that he needs a two-thirds vote of the House in order to pass legislation under that alternative route. And he's been doing that repeatedly, including, ironically, on the very budget bill that got Kevin McCarthy booted. You know, that was done on a bipartisan basis, but you did not have a majority of the House Republican caucus voting for that.
Yeah, if you wouldn't mind, just explain for people who don't remember what the Hastert rule
was. The Hastert rule, in simple English, meant, and still means for those who believe in it, that you don't put a bill on the floor unless it is supported by a majority of the majority, in this case, a majority of the 217 remaining Republicans. You know, and Mike Johnson has violated that rule more than once in the name of moving things forward. Secondly, I believe, I can't prove this, but But I believe that the House Minority Leader, Hakeem Jeffries, is dead serious when he says that if Johnson does the right thing on the bills that are now on the floor, and that triggers a motion to vacate, Jeffries will provide a sufficient number of Democrats, you know, to prevent Johnson from getting booted out. Because let's face it, if he were booted out, there would be months of chaos. And the Democrats don't want that. They have stuff they want to do. I don't mean this to sound like a partisan comment. I think it's simply an analytical truth that at this point, Republicans are more comfortable with chaos than Democrats are, because Republicans have very, very few things that they'd like to even try to do between now and the election. Democrats still have a fair number. So I take Jeffries at his word. And I think that that will strengthen Johnson's willingness to go out on what otherwise would be a limb that's too weak to hold him up. You know, it's very hard for me to preserve a shred of optimism after what we've been through recently, but I am modestly optimistic that Johnson will do the right thing, that he will find the requisite majority to get aid for Ukraine as well as Israel and Taiwan through, and that that will surprise many people on the upside.
Linda, I can easily imagine a different scenario, and strange as it seems, I'm kind of inclined to give the Democrats the benefit of the doubt here, but they seem sincere. I don't know. But, you know, you could easily imagine a political party in this situation saying, well, heck, I mean, the Republicans are in such trouble. They're in such disarray. Let them collapse. Let them have another embarrassing fight about having to replace a Speaker of the House in an election year with only 7 months to go before November. It'll be good for us. You know, the Ukrainians, not so much. You know, other allies, not so much. But boy, it would be good for Democrats. You know, you could see them saying, let's take that route. What do you think?
Well, no, I don't think they're going to take that route. I actually have a great deal of respect for Hakeem Jeffries. I mean, he seems a man who has principles. I do think they very desperately want to see aid to Ukraine pass. I think they understand, in the way that unfortunately growing numbers of Republicans don't understand, that this is not Ukraine, Russia. The war is not just Ukraine, Russia, that this is ultimately Russia's war against the West and Russia's war against the United States. And so I hope that's not going to happen. Now, this is going to really surprise you, Mona. I also think there is another person in this charade that has surprised me a little bit, and that's Marjorie Taylor Greene, who I heard speaking yesterday. She sounded almost statesmanlike. She said that, you know, she wasn't going to push this and bring this to a vote until they knew whom they could replace Mr. Johnson with. And the fact is, they don't have anybody, Mona. There is nobody. So, I mean, I think that they have suddenly come to the realization. I don't think she's, you know, the brightest bulb in the firmament. But on the other hand, she may be smart enough to realize, if we do this again, and we go through weeks of this kind of disarray, that cannot be good for us. And so I think that, as much as anything, is going to keep them from bringing this as a privileged item before the House. And if it is brought as such an item, I think Hakeem Jeffries is going to be true to his words and will supply the votes to keep Johnson from being kicked out, because we're in a very perilous time. The world is at war right now. We have a major land war on European soil in Ukraine, between Ukraine and Russia. We've got Israel and Iran having had this conflict. This is a very, very dangerous time. I mean, I look at the news and I feel like I used to as a kid back during the Cold War era. Things could spiral out of control very quickly. You cannot afford to have the House of Representatives become paralyzed and not be able to act at a time like this. So I hope there are enough people, even Marjorie Taylor Greene, who sort of realize, yeah, you know, maybe not such a good idea to do this.
Okay, Ben, did you want to make a follow-up point?
Yeah. So first of all, I fully agree that the Democrats at the leadership level anyway, when confronted with the question of whether to play games with this, will behave like patriots. That said, there is a group of Democrats who we should call out right now for the failure to do exactly that. And it is the left Democrats who have refused to sign the discharge petition. And they have refused because they hate Israel so much that they are willing to let Ukrainians die. And I think, you know, there was some symbolic gestures in that direction by Bernie Sanders in the Senate and some others in the Senate. And it was kind of harmless because they had the votes to pass. But here, by Democrats refusing to sign the discharge petition, they're actually alleviating pressure on Republicans to sign it. You need both to get this done. You need an absolute majority of House members. And every Democrat who refuses to sign it because of Gaza is enabling the Gallaghers, or actually, I think he did sign it on his way out the door, or maybe not, is enabling the Turners and company to justify not signing it. And so I think I very much agree with Linda about Hakeem Jeffries, but I do think we need to create an exception to our honorable mentions of democratic behavior here for those who are not behaving so.
Excellent point. Okay, thank you. All right, let us turn now to another major story this week, which is two aspects of Trump's legal trouble. So on the one hand, we have had the opening days, including jury selection in the election interference / hush money to a porn star case in New York. And we have also had the Supreme Court hearing oral argument on a challenge to one of the laws under which many of the January 6th defendants have been convicted. And based on the oral argument, a number of justices, maybe a majority, seemed dubious about this law, which could affect not just those people who stormed the Capitol, but also Jack Smith's case against Donald Trump. And for this, we are going to lean heavily on you, Ben Wittes, because you are following this very closely, and you have your people at Lawfare in the courtrooms and following this sort of minute by minute. So let's start, if we can, with the New York trial and how it's going. And did Trump really doze off?
So whether Trump dozed off or merely closed his eyes, I think requires, as I said before, being in the head of Donald Trump, where I try to spend as little time as possible. I think he appeared to close his eyes on a number of occasions, both days of the proceedings. I have to say, as somebody who, jury selection is really, really, really important, and it is, for those who are not true court nerds, really boring. And so I have to say, of all the things that Donald Trump has done that I would fault him for, if he in fact fell asleep on one or both days of jury selection, that strikes me as the most venial of sins that he maybe has ever committed. So how is it going? They have seated several jurors. Everybody expected this process to take sort of a minimum of a week and maybe up to 2 and 2.5 weeks. So it is going at roughly the pace that you would expect it to go. There have been a number of rulings by the judge on various motions on evidence matters. And I actually, this hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention, but he's ruled for Trump on some matters. There's some material that the prosecution wanted to present actually about the Access Hollywood tape that he is limiting their ability to present because he thinks it's so salacious as to be potentially prejudicial. So I think, you know, for all that Trump is on a campaign to defame Justice Merchan and to, you know, maybe subject his daughter to violence or assassination or whatever. The judge actually appears to be businesslike and serious. I think this case is, you know, going to proceed in a relatively expeditious fashion. It's not the world's most complicated case. And I think it will, you know, finding the 12 people and the appropriate number of alternates in New York City who have never thought hard about Donald Trump is, you know, that's an undertaking that is going to take a little bit of doing, but they'll get it done. They've gotten it done before in the Justice Merchan himself got it done in the Trump criminal trial of the Trump Organization, and the federal courts got it done in the E. Jean Carroll cases, and a different judge got it done in the fraud case that was brought by the state attorney general. So there is a history of seating juries, relatively recent history of seating juries in Trump cases in New York. And so, you know, for all the hand waving that people are doing about different aspects of this, I don't doubt that we will have a jury in the relative near term.
I thought it was rather fast. They had 7 jurors and something like 6 alternates or something in just 2 days. That seemed like the judge could get the whole thing completed by the end of the week, no?
As I say, it's certainly possible. This judge has a, I think, adorable habit of taking a midweek, what he calls day of rest. So he doesn't sit on Wednesdays. And actually, for a lovely reason, he does a mental health court on Wednesday mornings, and which is, you know, a service to the institution and to the community. And he decided not to suspend doing that for the duration of this trial. So we have the court sits 4 days a week. And I wouldn't be surprised if there were a jury sat by Friday. But, you know, he also may have gotten lucky. They seated nobody on Monday and a bunch of people on Tuesday. And so, you know, you could get unlucky Thursday and Friday, right? The other thing, of course, is that, you know, because both sides only have 10 peremptory challenges, which Trump is busy complaining about on Truth Social this morning, he's discovered that he doesn't have unlimited peremptory challenges, which I don't know why he didn't know that, but he seems very upset by this particular rule of criminal procedure. And, you know, people, good trial lawyers do tend to save their peremptory challenges for when they really need them. So I wouldn't be surprised either if a jury were sat by the end of the week or if it spilled well into next week. I'm quite confident that the New York system is capable of doing this in a timely fashion.
For the sake of the non-lawyers out there, I'll pull this out of my law school training. You can challenge a juror, prospective juror, for cause. So one of the prospective jurors in the Trump case had put on his social media page, lock him up regarding Trump. He was dismissed for cause, okay? That's the way that goes. Or if somebody says, I just think anybody the police arrest is guilty, that's a for cause challenge. A peremptory challenge, of which each side gets 10, is I just don't like the cut of his jib. Something about this woman gives me the willies. I don't think she's good for our side. And they're out. So just to clarify that. Yeah, Linda.
You know, I'm obsessed with this stuff and watch way too much coverage of it. And it struck me yesterday that Donald Trump has never, certainly in his adult life, had to sit in a room with his mouth shut and obey orders from another person for 8 hours a day, 4 days a week. In his life, he has never had to do this. I think it's going to be his undoing. I think it is going to drive him absolutely bonkers. I expect him to be having apoplectic fits sometime, at least in the second week of this trial, because I don't think he's capable of doing it because he's never had to. And I think that's part of his whole persona. And frankly, it is part of what people find attractive about him, this sort of strong man. And so I think this is going to be much more damaging than I originally thought, because I think it's going to do such great damage to his psyche. He is, you know, when he's coming out of those courtrooms every day, once or twice a day, and rambling on, it's not his usual powerful ramble. It's meandering. It's more subdued than usual. And so I really think this trial is going to take a toll on him.
Okay. Ben, let's look at the Supreme Court case. This involves a provision of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Explain how that is relevant to the Donald Trump cases.
So the relevant provision, which for the people who love citations to criminal statutes, is 18 U.S.C. 1512 C2. So the provision is framed as a generic obstruction provision that says, if you corruptly interfere with, obstruct, impede a federal proceeding, that's a 20-year felony. And a large number of January 6th protesters were indicted, some of the more violent ones, under this provision. And several of them, at least, are only indicted under this provision. And in addition, two of the counts against Donald Trump in the pending indictment against him are under this provision. And for a number of years now, and this is most best documented by my colleague at Lawfare, Roger Parloff, who has followed this issue from the beginning, there has been a dispute among the judges who are hearing these cases about whether this provision is quite as broad as it sounds. And there's a group of judges, both at one judge at the district court level, 14 others went the other way. But Judge Carl Nichols, who is not coincidentally or maybe coincidentally appointed by Donald Trump, felt that this statute should be read more narrowly so as only to include things that involved the damaging or tampering with evidence. And the reason for that, in his view, was that the previous provision, the one immediately before it, which is 1512 C1, says whoever mutilates, damages, doctors, I forget the exact language.
Spindle and mutilate.
Exactly. So it's all these things you can do to documents. And the C2 says, or otherwise obstructs a federal proceeding corruptly. And so the issue before the Supreme Court is whether the second provision is narrowed in some sense and is really only about document destruction or tampering. This will not prevent the case against Trump from going forward. It might narrow either the types of charges or the number of charges. The place where it will have a really big impact, if the court reads the statute narrowly, is on with respect to a fairly large number of mid-level offenders in the January 6th riot who were accused and convicted of violently interfering with the certification of the election. And this was one of the bread and butter charges that the Justice Department used.
So two of the charges that Jack Smith brought against Trump involve this offense. But it's different in his case, right? Because he was involved in the fake elector scheme, right?
So yes. And this, again, depends on how the court rules, right? But one possibility is the court would say, if you didn't mutilate a document or create a fake document, this statute doesn't apply to you, in which case those charges would drop out of the Trump case. And a bunch of people would get this charge dismissed from their criminal convictions. Another possibility is the court would say, and Justice Amy Coney Barrett was really flirting with this idea, that it has to have something to do with documents, but otherwise struck could say include seeking to prevent the electoral certifications from entering the Senate chamber, the House chamber, right? That these are, that that it can't, it's not a blanket anything you do to obstruct. It has to be have a linkage to documents, but this kind of obstruction can include things that happened in this case. So I think the specific manner in which the court rules matters a lot. And I will say, in defense of the conservative justices who were very skeptical of this, I don't think this is because they are in the tank for Trump. This is part of a much longer term, led by the Chief Justice, actually, concern about overbroad interpretations of criminal statutes. And I do think, you know, if you took this statute and put the same question in front of them in a very different context, I don't know about all of them, but John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh and the sort of would have a very similar skepticism as they displayed in this case.
It is interesting that it does seem to have been, at least at oral argument, a case of the boys versus the girls, all of the women justices on one side, all the men on the other. Well, we'll see. It may not turn out that way. All right. And also, we should bear in mind that we are now in the month that will also contain the oral argument about Trump's immunity claim. So that is coming up very shortly. Time to turn to our highlight or lowlight of the week. And Linda, you have a hard out, so I'm going to start with you.
I have a recommendation this week that comes to you. It might be a surprising source. A professor from Hillsdale College, William McClay, who wrote what I thought was an excellent piece on restoring civics in higher education. Bill McClay is somebody that I serve with on the board of the Jack Miller Center. And the Jack Miller Center promotes the idea of teaching civics and history in America's founding in American colleges. And he has written a very, I think, important piece about the movement to try to get teaching civics in colleges around the country. And it is in AEI's publication, Sketching a New Conservative Education Agenda, and I'll put a link out there so people can read it. He makes the point that from our founding, from George Washington on, the idea of having a populace that was educated in and had an understanding of American civics and our government and the way in which we govern ourselves was absolutely imperative to protecting democracy. And I still believe that. So I think it's an excellent article.
Thank you. Okay, Damon Linker.
Well, my low light of the week at first will sound maybe a little trivial, and I'll concede that at the base level it sort of is, but I mean to make a little bit of a broader point about it. This has to do with a conservative pundit named Eric Erickson. Erickson is several clicks to my right, but I've always often thought that he seems to be a decent guy who has good instincts, but he seems to have ended up trapped as a radio talker on the right, constantly in a position of having to revise his positions in light of the fact that his audience is with Trump and just keeps following Trump as Trump heads over the waterfall of anything resembling decency and proper civics. So the latest example of this is journalist Jeffrey Toobin just had a typical kind of snarky tweet on Twitter/X on Tuesday, relating to actually the Supreme Court arguments that Ben Wittes was discussing earlier. In oral argument today, Toobin said Justice Thomas is minimizing the severity of the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Perhaps that's because his wife was part of the conspiracy. What a disgrace that he's sitting in on the case. All right, leave that aside, whether that's fair. Erickson's response to this is to say, there was no insurrection. That is a left media talking point. It was a riot, yes. It was not an insurrection. Those who believe this don't actually care about the truth, though. To which I responded by saying, you know, I swear to God, he held a different position of this in real time. So I decided to go back and search Twitter's archives to find his tweets that I remember very vividly from that period. And lo and behold, I discover they're all gone. Every tweet from January 21, March, June, including February 21 during the second impeachment, June, September, not until December of 2021 are there any tweets available, which means he has erased the past. So I tweeted about this. And then, as Twitter does when it's at its best, you ended up seeing all these people doing using, I don't know, the Internet Wayback Machine or like some other people kept records of these things. There started to surface videos of Erickson denouncing the insurrectionists using that very term on January 6th and 7th and all of these other things that he wrote at the time. And I kind of followed up after that and said, you know what? I don't want to be too mean to Eric. This is pretty embarrassing. But let me say, he is not alone. Almost every Republican in office, and then so many conservative media personalities from Ben Shapiro all down, have done exactly the same thing. And Eric, just don't get up on your high horse about the truth anymore, because you do not have truth on your side. You have erased the past in order to give yourself a runway into this nonsense. And so anyway, I mean, like, does Eric Erickson matter not that much? Now, he's one data point, but you put all those data points together and you have the constellation of garbage that we live in our political system, and especially on the right. And it's just a kind of a telling anecdote, I think, the lengths to which these people will go.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's this constant battle that we're all waging about truth and about, you know, the willingness to airbrush things out of history. You know, we on the right used to have a field day making fun of the Soviets for their, you know, airbrushing various figures out of their history books, you know, out of the photographs, literally, you know, a picture of Beria, who was the head of the Secret Service, would be replaced by something about the Bering Sea. Anyway, now it's very much a phenomenon that we're dealing with on a daily basis. But it is interesting that because of the Wayback Machine and because of technology, we have more tools to fight the war for truth. But all right. Thank you for that. Let's move now to Bill Galston.
Well, for change, I have a highlight. As the faithful listeners, or now viewers, beg to differ, will know, I have spoken more than once about the dangers of the Insurrection Act, which gives the President of the United States the power to deploy the U.S. military in a range of circumstances that are very generally defined and in several cases not subject to congressional or judicial review. And I have pleaded publicly and privately for an effort to reform this law before it's too late, in the same way that a bipartisan majority in the Congress of the United States managed to reform the Electoral Count Act a couple of years ago. Well, there is some movement in this direction. The American Law Institute put together a bipartisan panel of serious scholars who came out with a pretty detailed five-page single-space statement of principles that the Congress, you know, could now use in order to draft legislation that cuts back the worst excesses of the Insurrection Act without abolishing it altogether. You know, there may be some efforts going on behind the scenes. I haven't seen a lot of public manifestations, but let me just express my fervent hope that people of goodwill on both sides of the aisle in Congress will recognize that this is a ticking time bomb at the heart of our constitutional system and will defuse it before it's too late.
Thank you. I heard a podcast with Bob Bauer and Jack Goldsmith. Jack Goldsmith is associated with Lawfare. And they wrote a book together about after Trump about reforms of various laws that the Congress should consider. Of course, they wrote that 4 years ago. Very little was actually done. But One of the things that they observe is that, you know, Congress has already constrained the president's war-making power with the War Powers Act. And one of the things that it does is it puts a time limit on how long you can deploy troops. And it's amazing that the Insurrection Act has no time limit. And so that seems like a fairly obvious one. Okay, let's go to Ben Wittes for your highlight or lowlight.
So I have to be careful about how I talk about this highlight, because as our fearless leader at this conference that Bill and Mona and I are all at always reminds us, we are under what he charmingly calls the Chatham House rule, as though there is only one of them. And that means that I am allowed to say what happens at this conference, but I'm not allowed to say who any of the speakers are. But last night, I was privileged to watch a truly wonderful moment in which one speaker got up to present an award to another speaker. And the award was for courage in the face of staring down one's own side when it is egregiously in error, and being willing to stand up to one's own side. And this person told a wonderful story about an incident that happened at CPAC a number of years ago, early in the Trump administration, in which the honoree was on a panel to discuss the Me Too problem and the Me Too issues, and insisted at CPAC that that there was an elephant in the room and we needed to talk about the Me Too problem at the White House. And I am unable to say either who presented this award or who received this award. I will merely say that the speech was incredibly moving and spoke for a large number of us. And the first three words of the speech were, Mona, Mona, Mona.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you, Ben. Ben.
I just want to say, I have no idea what you're talking about. I honor the one Chatham House rule that there is.
Well, thank you for that. All right. I want to praise a piece by David French. Honestly, I could do this every week. David is just the most remarkable writer and thinker. Also, one of the most prodigious and prolific writers out there. He is just, he's amazing. So as I say, I could praise him every week. This one I want to note, though, because both David and I have long been on the pro-life side of things in the national debate. But he speaks for me when he writes that there is no longer a pro-life party in the United States, which was predictable when Trump became the head of it. But in any event, he notes that after the Alabama State Supreme Court made the inference from a law that fertilized embryos were persons within the meaning of Alabama law and therefore effectively outlawed IVF, the Republican Party rushed to say, well, we don't want that. But of course, in doing so, they were contradicting the position that the pro-life movement has always taken, which is that life begins at conception and that all forms of human life, no matter how young and small, are deserving of the law's protection. And they did it kind of without a glance back or without even any blushes about how this was an open contradiction. And then he notes also that in the wake of Dodd, the poorly drafted abortion regulations, he says, have placed, quote, a terrible spotlight on conservative states, with many examples of punitive laws placing women who are suffering miscarriages or other pregnancy complications in profound danger. And this approach, he says, undermines pro-life arguments that the movement does, in fact, love both mother and child. I think that's a point that cannot be made too often, that the movement had an opportunity to show itself as a compassionate and loving movement that was concerned about the killing of the most vulnerable members of society. And the way to handle that is to be much more clear about providing help for mothers with crisis pregnancies, for example. But instead, the message has been entirely punitive, and also when it seemed like it was going to be politically painful for them, they abandoned their principles very, very quickly. So I recommend the piece called, I don't have the exact title in front of me, I think it was called There Is No Pro-Life Party Anymore. And we will put it in the show notes. And so with that, I would like to thank our special guest, Ben Wittes, and of course, our regulars, as well as our producer, Jim Swift, and our sound engineer, Jonathan Seary. Beg to Differ will return next week, as every week.